thank you for being here. What a wonderful turnout. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion at Drake, and I direct a public program in comparative religion that we call the Comparison Project, which is hosting tonight's event. The Comparison Project is an experimental effort in a philosophy of religion that is religiously diverse and historically grounded. Each year, we arrange for a year-long series of scholar lectures, practitioner dialogues, and philosopher reflections on a particular topic or problem. This year, our topic is religious responses to suffering. Through this program, we seek to educate about religious diversity, to provide forums for interfaith dialogue, and also to raise philosophical questions about meaning, truth, and value in religion. That's our core programming. I'm proud to say that this core programming will soon be supplemented. We've recently been awarded a grant that will not do that. That will help in the creation of digital stories by and about religious communities of Des Moines. We'll be beginning that project in the fall. All this, of course, requires considerable time and effort. Apropos of that, I want to thank some people who have helped make this possible, people without whom I would be sleeping less than I do. Todd Brown, our student research assistant, Carla Hurling, administrative assistant and web guru, and our funders, the Drake University Humanities Center, the Drake University Center for Global Citizenship, Humanities Iowa, the Medbury Fund, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, and Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Denning Foundation. And of course, I need to tell you that I need glasses. The opinions expressed in today's program do not necessarily reflect those of these supporters. I'm thrilled that someone else is with us tonight, my wife. It was, I think, a little over a year ago that we dreamed this in the kitchen of our apartment downtown. Do you remember that? I could not have done this without you, babe. Thank you. Three more quick items of housekeeping before I introduce tonight's speaker. If you want to know more about the Comparison Project, we have brochures outside that will at least tell you some of the future events for this year. One of our supporters, Humanities Iowa, requires us to take attendance. So I'll be passing this around in a minute. If you want to join our emailing list or Humanities Iowa emailing list, there's a place to sign up there. Humanities Iowa also invites evaluations of our program to know that their money is being spent well. So, if you have good evaluations, please. There are forms outside next to the brochures. Please, even if you have, you know, critical evaluations, we want to hear that. Let's go. We're so very honored to have with us tonight a scholar of the caliber of Dr. Stephen Katz. Dr. Katz is director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies and the chair in Jewish and Holocaust Studies at Boston University. Having served last academic year as senior scholar in residence at the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum, he currently chairs the Holocaust Commission of the Memorial Foundation for Jewish Culture and serves as the academic advisor to the academic working group of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. Dr. Katz has published countless articles and books in the fields of Judaica, Holocaust studies, philosophy of religion, and comparative mysticism. In 1999, he was awarded the University of Tübingen's Lucas Prize for Holocaust Studies. In his most recent book, Wrestling with God, Jewish Theological Responses During and After the Holocaust, was selected as runner-up for the 2007 National Jewish Book Award. I want to say that I also am very honored to have Dr. Katz with us tonight. Dr. Katz served as the second reader on my dissertation committee, In fact, it was during my very first semester of my PhD program in Dr. Katz's early Jewish mysticism class, which I was taking alongside a class in Ludwig Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, that I hatched the idea for my dissertation topic. So I owe him a debt of gratitude for that, and for the time that he spent reading and commenting on my writing since graduation. As I noted earlier, the theme for this year's comparison project is religious responses to suffering. Thus far, we have learned about suffering of Sikhs under Mughal rule in India, of the Lakota under American conquest of the West, of Muslims under the French occupation of Algeria, and of Africans under European enslavement in the so-called New World. And we're soon to learn, 13 days from today, about the suffering of the Chinese during the Nanjing Massacre. Every bit of this suffering was horrific and repugnant and cannot, indeed must not, be forgotten. But as Professor Katz has argued, quote, "The Holocaust is phenomenologically unique by virtue of the fact that never before has a state set out as a matter of intentional principle and actualized policy to annihilate physically every man, woman, and child belonging to a specific people. Unsurprisingly, the Holocaust has therefore given rise to numerous and diverse Jewish theological responses, many of which Professor Katz will mention tonight, and the most innovative of which Professor Katz will explore and evaluate tonight. Please join me in welcoming Professor Stephen Katz."
Tim. It's really a pleasure. You know, one of the things we do in academic life is follow our students, and we always like to see them succeed, and really it's a great pleasure to see the success that Professor Knepper is having. Also, I met with his class today and was really impressed with the questions that have been prepared in advance and with the whole nature of the conversation that I was able to have. I must say it was a very, very impressive performance. Also, I, of course, thank all the funders. As the rabbi said, Ein Kemach, Ein Torah. Without funds, there can't be Torah. Someone has to support scholarship. And so it's nice to know that the corn is being translated into something valuable. Tonight, I've been asked to take a look at some Jewish responses to the Holocaust. I use the word Shoah on occasion just for diversity. It's the Hebrew word we use for Holocaust. And I begin by saying this is a very difficult issue, lends itself to no easy answer. And in general, it undertakes a very serious matter, which is theology. Theology is always, always the most difficult of human arts because it doesn't just deal with human subjects. Trying to deal with God, a reality for which it's a complicated equation, makes it very difficult. They once asked Bertrand Russell, "Russell, if you die, you've been a lifelong atheist, and you go to heaven and you find out there's a God, what will you say to him?" And Russell replied, "I will say to him, Lord, Lord, you should have given us more evidence." And he was an empiricist right to the end. But the fact is, these are very difficult questions. And of course, they have produced many different answers. Not only Jewish answers, but non-Jewish answers, very complex subject. And of course, it calls into question all the main issues of Western thought. I don't have time to explore that, but I would assure you that if you were to look at the literature, you will see how almost every major field of study and all of the principles and all of the premises of Western traditional thought, whether it be philosophical, ethical, communal, sociological, economic, political, are put into question by what happened in the death camps and by the Einsatzgruppen. You've had this such a radical event. It took place in the heart of modern Europe, engaged all the main countries of the continent, cost not only the 6 million Jewish lives, but up to 50 million other lives, that it's a kind of circumstance that needs to be plumbed in great detail. As regards theology, I would say it calls into question all the main theological conditions, all the premises, all the answers, not only Jewish but Christian. The same questions that are attacked in the Jewish theological universe: how could God allow it? What is the meaning of it? Where was God during it? Christians also have to ask if the God of love is the definition of the Christological reconstruction of the Almighty, then how could the God of love allow it, sit by and watch it, for some justify it? Also, it raises all kinds of really basic questions. I don't know if what I'm about to say will be altogether clear to all of you, but I hope some of it will be when I tell you that it raises really groundbreaking, essential research into theological vocabulary. For example, the thinkers I'll talk about tonight, and almost any thinker that you could take who does theological work, deals with the question of revelation. But what is revelation? It's not an obvious question. That is to say, is history revelation? Is nature revelation? Is Auschwitz revelation? Again, we have to ask the question, is history revelatory? Does history make things clearer? Does God talk to us through historical events? Is he telling us something through the death camps, through the collapse of Western civilization? Because we're talking about Jews, one always has to ask the question, do Jews have a special status? What is the meaning of being the people who are the chosen people? Does it mean being chosen for death? Chosen to be immolated? To have one's ashes spread over the ponds that circulated around Auschwitz? To have 1.5 million Jewish children killed? Also, it raises the question of salvation. What would salvation look like if we want to talk about theology? We always have to talk about theology. And in that context, I will come back to a subject that doesn't get enough conversation in Jewish circles. What is the meaning of the State of Israel? Today, the State of Israel is under enormous political attack. I spend a lot of time in my role as the academic advisor to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, an alliance of 31 countries. Last week, I was in Greece and Italy, 3 weeks before in Spain and Ireland, next week in Hungary with the Jobbik, who have 43 seats, anti-Semitic party in the Hungarian parliament who deny the Holocaust, the Golden Dawn in Greece deny the Holocaust, and also deny the State of Israel. What is the meaning of the State of Israel in all of this? And then there's a very simple question, what is the meaning of God? If I had a whole semester with the very good students I saw today, we might explore the many different meanings of God that have been generated in response to the Shoah. Martin Buber said that he's always present and he's an eternal thou. Richard Rubin said there is no God. God is dead. Others have said, like Mordechai Kaplan, God is the power that makes for salvation in the universe. Some have been traditionalists. Melissa Raphael, a very extreme thinker in England, says God is a mother. So these are all questions, and I raised them for you just to start your conceptual juices working, to realize that what we're about to talk about is a very difficult, very diverse, very variegated kind of phenomenon. Tonight, in the short 2 or 3 hours I have, I will talk about a couple of major thinkers. I'll do it in a way that unfortunately will be limited in scope. I will not be able to do justice to any of them. All of them are major figures. All of them deserve enormous respect for attempting what they attempted, knowing how difficult it is. All of them did it in good faith. I knew almost all of them very intimately and personally, though I disagree with all of them. The first set of responses I'd like to discuss are, not surprisingly, the recycling of biblical materials. You know, when you have a religious tradition, you don't start from ground zero when you try to find answers. You are constrained in what you can say, and you are implored to look at traditional responses as resources. What does the tradition have to say about suffering? What does the tradition have to say about the problem of evil? What does the tradition have to say about the persecution of the Jewish people? These are not new questions. The biblical evidence, especially for people who are deeply immersed in these subjects, becomes a primary subject. And it's not surprising that we find five or six basic motifs that come to us from the Bible being reapplied, of course, with a certain novelty, with a certain adjustment, with a certain revision to the contemporary environment. The first is a very well-worked theme in Jewish historical writing, theological writing. It's the Akedah. The Akedah, which you know better as the binding of Isaac, the binding of Isaac, which we read about in the book of Genesis in chapter 22. I hope most of you remember the story. God loves Abraham, but in order to make sure that Abraham is the right person to be the father of the Jewish people, to make sure that the covenant going forward that God wants to create with mankind should be through Abraham, he tests Abraham through 10 tests, and the 10th test is the most extraordinary. He says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, your beloved son, ignoring, of course, Ishmael, the son of the maidservant, take him and bind him and sacrifice him. And Abraham does something very remarkable. Earlier, he had argued with heaven over the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah. But now God says to him, take your son, murder him, and he doesn't say anything. He gets up early in the morning, according to the Bible. He doesn't tell Sarah what is going to be the event of the day. He takes his son, he takes a knife, a donkey, and a servant. He goes off by tradition to Har Abayah, to the same mountain where the temple now stands. And he's about to sacrifice his son, and an angel comes from heaven and stays his hand and says to him, God now knows that you love him, that you're obedient unto death, and so he makes the covenant. We know that this is an act of great puzzlement, because I just point out to you that when Abraham comes back, he never again talks to God. And after this, Sarah dies. The tradition is she learned what had happened and it took her life. So this is an event of momentous significance, killing your son. What did it mean? Usually interpreted as the way the Bible dramatically teaches us against child sacrifice. But here it means something else. Namely, God makes unique demands on those he loves. And this theme reverberated through the Middle Ages. Those of you who know something about Jewish history know that in the Middle Ages, there was a tradition that grew up when the Crusader hordes fell upon Jewish communities, especially in the Rhineland, and gave them the choice of death or conversion. They killed their children, and they called it killing for the sake of heaven, Al-Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of the name of God. And so the idea of this parent-child relation, which turns into a murderous one, has a long and curious history in Jewish religious thought. Now again, after the Holocaust, people looked to it and said, you know, this again is what happened. God is testing the Jewish people. Now this had an attraction above all for one reason. It does not impute sin to the victims. I want to stress that. It does not impute sin to the victims. It does not say that God is punishing the children of Israel. Instead, it looks for a positive explanation, positive in the sense that it sees Israel's test as the merit of Israel, as the special relationship that God has with Israel, of the willingness of the people to die for the sanctification of the name, martyrdom. However, though this has deep emotional power because of its historic connections, And because it does not attribute sin to the victims, it's still very problematic. And it's problematic for one important reason. When you make analogies, you have to find analogies that are appropriate, that are structurally appropriate. If you make an analogy between the Shoah, the Holocaust, and the sacrifice of Isaac, you find a very inappropriate element at its core. In the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, it is Abraham who is tested. And it takes all of Abraham's courage and all of Abraham's fundamental character to test himself against this demand to sacrifice his son. But in the Holocaust, the murder was carried out not by someone like Abraham, but by Adolf Hitler, by Heinrich Himmler, by Reinhard Heydrich, by Adolf Eichmann. They had no trouble killing Jewish children. So there's no analogy. The test, there's no test for them. The demand is no great demand for them. And therefore, one has to be cautious, I think, about moving in the direction of the Akedah. The second major model, biblical account, that I spent a lot of time, very pleasantly, I must say, talking to students about today, was the book of Job. You know, these are not new issues. In the book of Job, it's a biblical book. Comes to us in the period after the destruction of the first temple, the 6th century. People were perplexed. How could God destroy his own temple? How could he send the people of Israel into exile in Babylonia? How could he give victory to the Babylonians? After all, Babylonia was much worse than Israel in its behavior and its morality. And so the book of Job conjures with all of these issues. And throughout the first 36 chapters of the book, it's very puzzling. Job has a series of friends. I assume you all know the book. And the friends repeat all the classical answers that you find in different parts of the Bible, especially the book of Jeremiah about sin, the book of Deuteronomy about sin. But Job says, no, I know this is untrue. And you and I know that it's untrue because we know the prologue where all of the misfortune of Job takes place, because God has made a test case at the request of Satan to test Job's faith. So we know Job is not a sinner. But he suffers terribly. He loses his wife, he loses his children, he loses his wealth, he loses his reputation. And then the dramatic turn comes in the book. But what we get is not a normal answer, like I would give you an answer, or a professor would give an answer. A student would ask Professor Knepper for an answer, and he would give an answer like God gave to Job. They would not give Professor Knepper tenure. The fact is that God comes out of the whirlwind, and he pulverizes, pummels Job, and says, "Idiot, where were you when I created the world? You know how nature works? You know how the seasons come and go?" Of course, Job knows nothing of this. Who is Job? And so Job falls on the ground and he says in a very, very important passage, the turning, the crux of the book says, "Until now I've heard about you. Someone told me about you. But now I've heard you. I know you exist." And that makes all the difference. And in some way that's fundamental to all conversations. If you know that there really is a God, because after all, ladies and gentlemen, that's the underlying anxiety that we all bring to these issues. Is there really a God? Or is it a myth? Is it something that we've invented? Xenophon said, if donkeys could talk, gods would be donkeys. But the fact is, Job says, no, there is fundamental proof, religious experience. Job encounters God. And therefore, in a very important sense, Job's questions are answered. Not in the normal way, but now he knows that even though he doesn't know, that is to say, he doesn't know how the world is governed, why the Holocaust happened, why there were death camps. He knows that someone's in charge who knows why there were death camps. He knows that all of this is meaningful. He knows that existence is not random, absurd, absurdity. And that's a very powerful answer if you think about it. If you and I would hear the voice of God clearly speaking to us, even if it said to us, "You're worthless. Who are you to question my governance of the world?" We would fall on our knees and say, "Hallelujah." The problem is that in our age, religious experience is not plentiful. We don't have a lot of burning bushes. However, I want to suggest to you that this makes the book of Job problematic. Had we some kind of religious experience like Job had, then you and I could be believers in the same way that Job is an unquestioned believer. Be'emunah shleimah, with perfect faith. However, there is a question, and I leave it to you as a question. How should we really read what happened? Did God completely leave behind human history? Did he evacuate his role, providential orderer? Did he abandon the Jewish people? The answer to that question, when we study the Holocaust, the Shoah, we usually say yes. That's why we're troubled by this. Where was God when the millionaire children were being immolated? Where was God when the Einsatzgruppen were murdering Jewish women day after day in the thousands? Where was God when the Greek Jewish women were being put to terrible medical experiments by Mengele and Klauberg? Sterilization, abortion. But maybe, and as I say, the maybe we are too narrow in our perspective. Maybe there was a victory. Not a normal victory. But then we're dealing here with abnormal things, with things that are not of the ordinary sort, like chairs and tables, or even regular historical events. Perhaps two things should be borne in mind. One, if you read the worldview of Adolf Hitler from his side, you see that he thought the destruction of the Jewish people was absolutely necessary for all future European progress. That until the Jewish people in its totality was destroyed, the Aryan people would be imprisoned, dominated, subverted, polluted by this inherently criminal race of Unterdimension, subhumans. As I mentioned to the students today in his last will and testament, what's he have on his mind? Germany has collapsed. Millions have died. The Wehrmacht is in retreat everywhere. Germans are being raped by the tens of thousands by Russian soldiers. Berlin is in flames. And so on the eve of shooting himself, he writes his last will and testament, the essential message of which is, "I commit the German people to continue the fight against the Jews." That's what's on his mind. He's been killing 17,000 Jews per day in the spring and summer of 44 when he destroys Hungarian Jewry. 436,000 Jews are deported from Hungary in 56 days. About 375,000 of them are murdered. But the Jews, in his view, are all powerful. They control the destiny of the world. Churchill, the Jew. Roosevelt, the Jew. 17,000 powerless Jews every day becoming ash. But maybe he knew something. Maybe he knew that his view meant that unless he won, he lost. By won, it means all the Jewish people disappear. If all the Jewish people don't disappear, if all the Jewish fetuses are not aborted, if all the Jewish children are not murdered, if all the Jewish mothers are not annihilated, if the Jewish people survive, then the race war, as he sees it, continues. And if the race war continues, it means the Jews have won. Now, that's a perverse idea in light of what we're talking about. I'm sure it's not an idea you've ever thought about, but that's why I come from the East Coast, to bring you perverse ideas. In this pristine city of yours, I drove around tonight, all very beautiful. You wouldn't have perverse ideas like this. You would outlaw them in Iowa. But the fact is that this, from a structural point of view, needs to be considered. Secondly, it needs to be considered in alliance with another idea I'll return to, and that is the state of Israel. What is the theological, not the political, the theological significance, especially from a Jewish point of view, of a recreated state of Israel? After 2,000 years of exile, where the entire structure of Jewish life turned on the dialectic of exile and redemption, and in that sense repeats the prophetic message. The prophets are all about the return to the land. The famous Gemara, rabbinic teaching in Makot, Talmudic tractate Makot, Rabbi Akiva is walking on the Temple Mount. You all know Rabbi Akiva, the great second century sage, with some of his colleagues, and they see the destruction of the temple. And he looks up and he sees a fox running across the Temple Mount. And his colleagues cry, and he laughs. And he said, Akiva, how can you laugh when you see a fox where the Holy of Holies used to be? And he says to them, you know, it says in the book of Jeremiah there will be destruction. And it says in the book of Isaiah there will be a fox and there will be redemption. Well, we've seen the destruction, and now that I see the fox, I know there'll be redemption. In other words, the prophetic message is the state of Israel, the fulfillment of some kind of transcendental prophecy. Is the ingathering of the exiles something of enormous theological weight? Is the fact that there's a Jewish state something so dramatic, so remarkably different, that we need to consider its theological import? I don't answer that question. I merely leave it to you to think about. The next answer, the next subject, is the suffering servant. Now, this is better known from Christian thought, Book of Isaiah, chapter 53. There's a description there of a suffering servant who God brings terrible plagues upon in a kind of vicarious suffering, that the plagues that come upon him save others from suffering those plagues. In Jewish historical writing, Jewish theology, there are two interpretations. The Christian interpretation is clear that it's Jesus. The Jewish interpretation tends in its weight to favor the view that it's the Jewish people who are the suffering servant, though there is a minority tradition that sees the suffering servant as an individual. But in either case, the suffering servant is a very important theme in traditional life. And again, something like the Akedah, God visits those he loves with special burdens. God brings their special sharing of his concerns with humanity together. They help somehow deflect the more terrible fate for humankind, which it deserves because of its sinful nature. Just as the crucifixion in Christianity takes on the sins of mankind since the sin of Adam and opens the gates of heaven again. But the question is this really an answer that we want to accept? And the reason is, I ask you, again, to think with me. I've thought about it a great deal. What kind of a God would kill 6 million people in this way? Would that make God more terrible than any other answer about God? That God kills people for vicarious reasons. They didn't do anything. They were not guilty. The children hadn't done anything inappropriate, and yet they suffer the terrible fate that they suffer. So this does not appeal to me. that killing 6 million as a vicarious sacrifice to save others would be the work of a just God. Seems to me a perversion. There are Christian theologians in particular who have used this in various ways with well-meaning intent to see the Jewish people as the suffering servant, but it doesn't matter whether in a Christological or rabbinic context, it seems to be a perverse idea. There's also the biblical idea of Hester Panim, that God hides his face. Maybe that's an answer. God is not responsible for what happened. In the Bible, we read in a couple of places, in the book of Micha and also in Deuteronomy, that God gets so upset with humankind that he simply can't stand it. And so he says, a plague on all your houses, he turns his back on humankind, he withdraws to the world above, and he lets the world go in its chaotic, anarchic orbit. Hester Panim. There are other places, especially in the book of Psalms, where God is said not to disappear because we're sinners, but simply for reasons of divine mystery. We don't understand them. And there you find the very plaintive cry of the psalmist, where are you, O God? Why do you betray? Why are you not here? Why do you not show yourself? Why do you not make yourself present? And Martin Buber, especially in a famous book called The Eclipse of God, I assume you all know Martin Buber, a very famous Jewish thinker, German origin, lived through the war, was the leader of German Jewry in the 1930s, managed at the last minute to get out of Germany to go to live in the land of Israel, became a professor of sociology because the religious wouldn't trust him to be professor of theology or philosophy. And so he was at the Hebrew University. He was an advocate of binationalism. He was not a popular figure for that reason in many circles in Israel. He became famous because Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, talked about all the things he did in Israel, one of which was stroking Martin Buber's snowy white beard. But the fact is that he used this. God was hiding. God was hiding. Now, in one way, it's a nice idea because it does not give God responsibility. It does not blame God for the evil. Men did the evil to each other. Human beings, reduced to the lowest level, caused all of the suffering. And it does not impute sin to Israel. We don't understand. We don't understand. However, what the result of turning to Hester Panim is that you use the mystery of God's hiddenness to explain the mystery of the Holocaust, which is not very satisfactory. That turns out not to be much of an answer. You can, you know, in logic, you can't have two unknowns in a proposition. Well, here you can't have two unknowns either. To say that you don't know what you don't know about what you don't know turns out not to be very powerful theology. Lastly, well, next to last, I want to just mention the most important traditional Jewish explanation, Nechateinu, because of our sins we are punished. If you read from the Bible to the contemporary ultra-Orthodox, you will see that the most repeated explanation, including in our own time by the ultra-Orthodox, is that Israel is punished for their sins. Nechateinu. That sin has consequences. I said to the young people today, that's not something most people today believe. That sin has consequences. If we believed it, we wouldn't all be sinners. The one thing I'm talking about tonight that I have the feeling most of you have some empirical experience of is sin. We're all sinners. We don't pay much attention to the biblical rules, even the ethical rules. The Ten Commandments are larger than the Ten Suggestions in many courts. Nechateinu, because of our sins. Now, this is a powerful traditional idea, but then you have to ask yourself, what kind of sin? It's a deep question. There's a famous Rav in New York, Rav Huttner, who said, And Teitelbaum, the Sutner Rebbe, was even more famous for this explanation, that God was very angry with the Jewish people. And the Holocaust was an expression of his anger. And we know in the Bible it says that God gets angry. Divine wrath is a serious business. But I ask those who put forward this view, and I ask all of us together to think about it, what kind of sin could Israel have committed to justify such a punishment? What kind of sin? Now here, there are two that are ex post facto that are the dominant themes. I just mentioned them. I don't endorse them. I think both of them are incorrect. One is Zionism. It may surprise you, but there's a whole school of ultra-Orthodox Jewish thinkers who reject Zionism. They reject Zionism because there's a Talmudic teaching, a story, let me put it, an agadic story. That is a not a legal story that has binding meaning, but an agadic story, a kind of legend, that after the destruction of the Second Temple, God said to the Jewish people, let's make a deal. I will protect you from extermination if you will not try to bring the redemption through human means, through human effort. You shouldn't try to bring the Messiah by your energy. And that was the agreement. The Jewish people for 2,000 years since the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 of the Common Era lived in the ghetto, lived in the melas, lived in the outskirts of society, passively, essentially, waiting for God to redeem them. Then the Zionist movement came along, and the Zionist movement, led by Herzl and then others, started to buy land, build settlements, and eventually created a Jewish state for the ingathering of the exiles. To what was called in traditional terms, force the Messiah, is the way the ultra-Orthodox saw it, to force the Messiah. God was angry because the Jewish people had broken this ancient pledge of 2,000 years ago. And so he punished Israel because of Zionism. Seems to me to be absurd. Secondly, the other explanation which you find is Reform Judaism. You know Shakespeare's play, Measure for Measure. That's actually a title that could be borrowed from rabbinic literature. The rabbis believed in what was called midah keneged midah, measure for measure, that the punishment fits the crime, that when something happens, there's a consequence of an equal kind. Well, what was the great sin of Israel? The great sin of Israel was Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism rejected the tradition. Reform Judaism came from Germany. Reform Judaism broke all the rules. So God brings from Germany the great punishment, which is Hitler. Of course, both of these fit very nicely into the worldview of the ultra-Orthodox, but they don't make a lot of sense from a point of view of the Jewish people. Lastly, of the classical answers, I just would mention the notion of the free will defense. Free will defense, you all know, says the reason there's evil is because men and women are given the capacity to do evil. God creates us with a will. The will can determine whether we go to the right or we go to the left, whether we do the good or do the bad. And the Holocaust is a misuse of human freedom. And therefore you can't blame God. And that, of course, is a nice answer again because it rescues the divine and it does not impute sin to Israel but to those who would murder them. Also, this idea that God gives us freedom is associated often with the notion that God, because he loves us, is long-suffering with us. He waits for the sinner to redeem himself, to do repentance, as we say, teshuvah, and therefore he has to allow the sinner to be sinful, which of course takes a toll on the righteous. Now this is a very, very well-known theory. I think today in the philosophy of religion, forgetting Jewish things, Professor Nepa could probably tell you that if you were to read the literature on theodicy, why does God allow things that look unjust or defending God's justice, perhaps the way they would put it, you would find the free will defense very widely used by contemporary theologians, philosophers of religion. However, I would put it to you that there are two problems here. One, we know that in the biblical story, in the biblical tradition, in the history of Israel, God does not stay neutral always at terrible times. If the historical record was of a God like the deist God, one George Washington, Ben Franklin believed in, a God who sets the universe in motion, winds up the clock, and then goes on holiday to Miami, that would be okay. But the God of the Bible is not a God who's a deist. He's a theist. He intervenes. Last week was Passover. What's the story of Passover? And God heard the cries of the people of Israel. God heard the cries. And he came and he picked Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our teacher, to be the leader of the redemption. And he brings Pharaoh to his knees. And he takes this slave people with nothing to recommend them except that they're the heirs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to freedom and to the promised land. Well, if that's the case, if we have in the prophetic literature that God interferes against the prophets of Baal for Elijah, if we have other occasions in rabbinic literature where God comes to the aid of the Jewish people, how could he stay silent? How could he stay silent? Now here, of course, again, it may be that he didn't stay silent for the reasons I mentioned earlier about the state of Israel, but I leave that undeveloped. It's a subject one has to think very deeply about. Secondly, I would say that when you use the free will defense, there's something else that needs to be sort of kicked around intellectually, conceptually. If we say that God is the creator of human beings, that we are his creatures, and that's what we say all the time in Jewish tradition, that we are his creatures, we are his servants, we look for him to redeem us, then the question is, perhaps he could have done a little better in his design of who we are. If we say that you and I have a capacity to will, perhaps he could have tweaked it a little bit and given us a slightly stronger capacity to will the good and not the evil. Would that have destroyed creation? Would that have violated the principle of human freedom? Would that have made a mockery of the universe? So this question needs to be looked at in different kinds of ways that make the free will defense less than a satisfying one. Now, those six answers are classical recycling of biblical material. At the same time, there are a number of modern thinkers who've done really what I'd call heroic work, trying to find modern answers, partly, of course, always drawing on the past, but seeing that this calls for new examinations, new evaluations, new sorts of reflection. The first person I'd like to mention, who was perhaps the most influential in the 70s and 80s, was a man named, maybe in the 90s even, named Emil Fackenheim. I don't know if any of you know the name. Emil was a wonderful man, originally came from Germany, studied for the Reform Rabbinate in Germany. Hitler came to power, he had to run away. He found refuge in Scotland, came to Canada, became a PhD at the University of Toronto, wrote a very famous book on Hegel, wrote on other German philosophers like Fichte and Schelling, and then became a professor at eventually the University of Toronto and a really world-class academic. Forget Jewish things, a world-class academic. After the 67 war, he was so shaken by the war and by the study of the Holocaust, which he had lived through, that he started to think about how to deal with it, how to say something philosophical about it. And he came up with a very interesting idea. He said, you know, it's very difficult to explain the Holocaust. And Holocaust does not lend itself to simple or even complicated explanations. So we might have to give up explanation. However, what the Holocaust does call for is response. We have to respond. We, you and me, we have to do something. It's It's not just a historical event. It makes demands on us. We have to see that what happened there has implications for our time. That what happened to them puts an obligation on us. And what was the obligation? He said something very interesting. Came a huge sensation in the day. Some of you are a little older will remember, if you were interested in Jewish things in the 70s, 80s, that he said what we need to do is we have to say about Auschwitz that from Auschwitz comes a 614th commandment. What does that mean? In traditional Jewish life, the claim is made by the sages that if you read the Bible and you interpret the Bible fully, you'll find that there are 613 commandments in the Bible. 258 positive, the rest negative. And that's the body of rabbinic law. That's the body of Jewish tradition. Now Abel said, out of Auschwitz comes another commandment. 614th commandment. What is the 614th commandment? Thou shalt not give Hitler posthumous victory. Very powerful phrase. Every one of us should understand that if we don't defend the Jewish people, if we don't defend the state of Israel, if we don't defend Jewish tradition, if we don't defend the right, if we don't defend the poor, if we don't defend the minorities, if we don't defend against racism, we will be assisting Adolf Hitler. After all, what did Hitler want? If we run away from our Jewishness, if we don't raise Jewish children, if we don't give them the future, then we give Hitler posthumous victory. We're helping him destroy the future. He'll create a world that's Judenfrei, free of all Jews. Not through the gas chambers, but through acculturation, assimilation. It's a very powerful message, especially to an American Jewish community, a Canadian Jewish community, a Western Jewish community that was wrestling with the issues of identity, religious belief, religious performance. And so there was a lot of power here. However, not to go very far in a philosophical direction, I just point out the deep philosophical problems, because he uses the word 614th commandment, and you would have to ask, if this was Professor Nepper's seminar, not a lecture like this, we'd have to ask, what does the word commandment mean? Usually it means a commander, right? That there is a commander. The word mitzvah in Judaism, commandment, is drawn from the idea that there's a mitzvah, there's a commander. But was there a commander here? Or did Abel invent this in his study? Secondly, and more importantly, there's a question that raises itself and needs to be thought about. Do we want to say to our children that you should be Jewish to spite Hitler? That's a deep question, ladies and gentlemen. Do we want to say that we're going to continue Jewish life, that we're going to take all the risks that Jewish life entails, right? Again today, the Golden Dawn in Greece, the Abik Party in Hungary, the Le Pen Party in France, the Nationalists in Scandinavia, the Svoboda in the Ukraine. They'd all like to destroy the Jewish people. Wouldn't it be better, perhaps, if we all converted and ended it, put an end to the possibility of another Holocaust? Are we going to do all of the things we need to do for Jewish survival despite Hitler? And obviously, when we think of it that way, the answer must be no. We must be committed to Jewish tradition for the other 613 commandments. That there's something deeply positive and meaningful in Jewish life. Otherwise, why bother? If there's nothing in the other 613 commandments, there's not much to recommend this position. The second innovative thinker I want to just mention, and I'll go through these rather briefly, is a man named Irving Greenberg. Some of you may know, he's known as Yitz Greenberg. He's really quite a remarkable personality, comes from an Orthodox family. He became the intellectual leader to the American Jewish community. He's the one who coined the phrase, leaders should be learners. And so he took Jewish leaders and he insisted that communities start educational programs for their big financial supporters, that it wasn't enough to give money. You had to really be Jewishly involved, committed, day schools, Israel, Sabbath. But Yitz had a very interesting thing. He said, you know, the Holocaust is so radical that it forces us to rethink even the most basic ideas. What was the most basic idea? That God and the Jewish people had a covenant, and that this covenant was unbreakable and eternal, the way it describes it in the Bible. Yitz said, the Holocaust ends the covenant between God and Israel. It's a remarkably extreme position for someone who wears a skull cap. It would be remarkable for somebody who didn't wear a skull cap. God and the Jewish people have ended their relationship. Why? Because what was the nature of the covenant? The covenant, Yitz said in a very catchy phrase, gave the Jewish people a mission. Right, a mission, light unto the nations, or Goyim. Gave them an eternal mission to be a holy people, a nation of priests. But it also, in World War II, showed they gave them another mission, a suicide mission. And it said, you cannot command a suicide mission. Suicide mission has to be voluntary. You can't command a suicide mission. And therefore, this shows the war ended the covenant. If there is any bond between Israel and God, it's now that Israel is the senior partner. Israel must do the doing. Israel must create a state. Israel must defend itself. Israel must change the law. Israel must innovate in matters of halakha, of Jewish tradition. And God may be there, but he'll be a junior partner only. Very interesting idea. God will be a junior partner. However, the fact is, we need to ask deep questions. If one takes seriously that there ever was a covenant, could Hitler break it? In other words, could Hitler have the capacity to break a covenant that God himself had enshrined as eternal? From a Jewish point of view, of course, that seems to be impossible. Secondly, can we ever really say that God is a junior partner? If we do, what happens to all of the Jewish tradition? Take a simple case, the Day of Atonement. We go to the synagogue, we fast, we ask God to forgive us, and then we add a note as a junior partner. Right? It just doesn't make sense. And therefore, the whole effort at this radical revision, for all of its genius, and I want to say he's a very close friend. He doesn't like it that I'm his leading critic, but the fact is it just doesn't hold up. Also, there are even more radical views. There are two I share with you. One is by a man named Richard Rubenstein. Richard was a very provocative character in the 1960s. He was at that time a Hillel rabbi at the University of Pittsburgh. He had studied, received a PhD from Harvard University School of Theology. He was very much influenced by a group of Christian theologians who were then known as Death of God theologians, who argued that they need to be religious despite the fact that there is no God. And Richard shared that view, and he made a simple syllogism. He said, if there was a Holocaust, there can't be a God. There was a Holocaust, therefore there is no God. Very simple, very plausible. And a lot of people found it very attractive. However, I would point out to you that this turns on a lot of assumptions. One, it turns on the assumption that we can read theological meaning simply off historical evidence. Secondly, and more puzzling, it raises the question, which I started early on this evening with, is and how is history a source of revelation? I just want to give you a simple experiment. If you think of history from 1933 to 45, then it's dark. Though not all dark. There were people who were heroic. There were people who rescued. There were governments who rescued. There were the righteous of the nations. But it was a minor note, undoubtedly a very minor note. And therefore, you could say, take all the evidence from Auschwitz, from Treblinka, from Sobibor, from Felno, from Majdanek, and say, yes, there is no God. What happens if you say, you know, that's too narrow a span, that's an artificial construction? Why only consider the evidence from 1933 to 45? Why not consider the evidence from 33 to 48? What happens in 48? The State of Israel is created. The DP camps are empty. The American Jewish community starts to flourish as never before. Then you get a much more complicated situation regarding evidence. Some evidence is for, some evidence against. The negative evidence you deflect with the positive evidence. The positive evidence you deflect with the negative evidence. But you don't have the simple syllogism. The second thing that Richard did that was very, very interesting, he borrowed an idea from America's most well-known original thinker, a man named Mordechai Kaplan. Some of you may know the name. Do you have a Reconstructionist synagogue here in Des Moines? No? Okay. So that Mordechai Kaplan came from a very traditional home, was quite a remarkable figure, wrote a famous book in 1934 called Judaism as a Civilization. Clearly the most important book on Jewish theology written in the United States in the 20th century. But Kaplan had been influenced by people at Columbia University and others to give up the idea of traditional theology, traditional God. God was redefined by him as the power that makes for salvation in the universe, whatever that is. And he said, you know, even though there really is no traditional God, we have to be Jewish. Why do we have to be Jewish? Because in a world that is meaningless, we need to create community. And what's better at creating community than religious identity? So Richard Rubenstein borrowed that idea, and he said, you know, we should go on keeping Jewish practice. Because we need to have Jewish community in a world that's absurd, in a world where there's no God. We need to have community. But if one thinks about it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And therefore, I would say that this idea that you can make a simple analysis that says because of the Holocaust, there is only meaninglessness, there is only emptiness, there is no God, God is dead, turns out not to be quite so compelling as when Richard put it forward. Perhaps I'll just ask another philosophical question. Is God subject to empirical verification? Right? Can you just verify God empirically, the way you do other things, verify in a laboratory? That's really the nub of the philosophical issue. The other person I want to mention was Arthur Cohen. Arthur was a very talented person, studied at the University of Chicago, but despite that was very clever, and was very much influenced by people at the University of Chicago, which is not a good idea. And he also was a novelist, was an editor for some major publishing houses, and he was influenced especially by certain trends of thought that were taught at the University of Chicago, which said that you know what you have to do to save theology? You have to redefine the idea of God. After all, what gets us into trouble? What gets us into trouble is that we claim God is all-wise, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present. Right? You all know the traditional omnipredicates, omniscient, omnipotent, and so on. However, especially a famous Christian theologian named Charles Hartshorne, philosopher of religion, said, you know, if you said that God was not all-powerful, for example, or all-wise, then the Holocaust would not be a problem. Because then you could say God couldn't do anything about it, he didn't have the power. Or you could say God couldn't do anything different because he didn't know what to do, he was not all-wise, right? So if you change the definition of God, you solve the problem, and you can still be a theist. You still can believe in theology. But the question that I have is, can you save Judaism that way? Will Judaism mean anything if God does not have sufficient power to save? If God does not have sufficient power to redeem? If God does not have sufficient power to forgive? And those are all the traditional attributes. The Seder table last week, right? Talk about the Passover meal. The first half, we talk about the redemption from Egypt. The second half, we talk about the redemption that will come, the messianic redemption. And what do we say? Right? How many of you have been to a Passover meal? Right? Quite a number of you. What's the last thing we do with the Passover Seder? No, it's not the last thing. Right? The last thing we do is sing Chag Gadol, one kid, a song, children's song. Right, you all know it. You see, I'm not a music major. The fact is that one can sing such a childish song. But what do we end with? The last verse says, and the angel of death killed the shepherd who killed the ritual slaughter, who killed the goat. And then the next verse says, and God killed the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death who killed the ritual. In other words, the Seder ends with redemption. That God will redeem the world and make it perfect. It will overcome death. That's the deep meaning of the Passover. It's not historical. That's all in the past. The deep meaning of the Passover is now. It's going to be now. Tonight. Tonight's redemption. The cup of Elijah. Tonight. Now, all of that becomes meaningless with a God who has no power, with a God who's redefined in order to save the theological conversation. Better we should put up with the old God and the theological problems than take the new God who turns out to be a feat and provides no theological solution whatsoever. Now, I think I've already exceeded my time. I just want to say there are other answers. People like Emmanuel Levinas, who's very, very well known today, who said, you know, we shouldn't talk about theology, we should only talk about ethics. We should think about the Holocaust as a demand that we treat each other with ethical dignity, and that's an important message. That we should understand that the primary obligation is immediately placed upon us when we come into contact with another human being. Doesn't matter where God is, it doesn't matter what God does, it doesn't matter what theological niceties may attend or not attend. But there's a question from the Jewish point of view, and that is, what is the origin of this obligation? Do we have this obligation because it's a commandment? Or do we have this obligation for non-theological reasons? I'm reminded here, just thinking to myself, you know, at the end of the meal, on Passover, it's very much in my mind. My wife makes me do so much work on Passover. I feel I'm, you know, a slave again in Egypt. The power of the arts, that's right. The fact is that something very interesting. You know, at the end of the Passover, at the end of the meal, what do we do? What's the last thing we do? Anybody? What's the last thing we do? Right? All of you finished the meal in Des Moines. What did you do? You gave out a piece of afikomen, a piece of the matzah that was broken at the beginning. What is the afikomen, the matzah, the piece of matzah we break at the very beginning of the Seder from the middle? What does it stand for? Anybody know? It's not just for the children that they should steal the afikomen, right? And they should get a gift and you should engage them. They should be interested. My little grandchildren, they stole the afikomen, then my 4-year-old granddaughter brought it back. She didn't realize that I had to give her a present first. So news came from the back of the house. One of the boys kicked her in the butt because she brought back the afikomen. So the fact is, what do we do? The afikomen is symbolic of the paschal sacrifice. That's the meaning of the afikomen. Now, when do we eat the afikomen? We eat it at night. When do we eat it? We eat it after the meal. What's the purpose of saying we eat it after the meal? We eat it after the meal so we don't say that we ate the afikomen, we ate the paschal sacrifice because we were hungry. We didn't eat the paschal sacrifice because we were hungry. We took the risk of the paschal sacrifice of killing the lamb and putting the blood on the doorpost, which was horrific for the Egyptians who worshiped the lamb, to show our faith in God. That's why we eat the meal first. To make it clear that we're not doing this for culinary reasons. for reasons of gastronomical satisfaction. We're doing it because it's a commandment. You should put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. You should make the paschal sacrifice. So if the ethical doesn't base itself on the commandment, if it's not rooted in a divine command, then what status does it have vis-a-vis the tradition? Now, these are all very remarkable answers. I've been very quick with them, and I apologize, but Tim only invited me for one day. So the fact is that these require you to think about it, to go home and think about them. Honestly, water. Think about it. Very difficult. The last one I just share with you is my colleague Elie Wiesel. As Tim said, I've been the director of the Elie Wiesel Center for 17 years. Elie's been my colleague day by day during that period. We're very old friends. Goes back long before the 17 years. You all know Elie's work. He's the most remarkable personality of our time in Jewish life. He says the answer really is silence. And others have said it too, people like Nellie Zox, who won his Nobel Prize for her poetry. Silence. Now that's an interesting answer. There are two kinds of silence. There's the silence of superficiality. I don't want to be bothered. I don't have anything to say about that. Leave me alone. Then there's the profound silence that comes after you do all the investigating. The profound silence that comes when you've explored every possibility. When you've tried to grasp what it must have been like to live in a death camp for a few hours. What it must have been to be in a ghetto like Warsaw or Lodz. What it must have been to hear the Einsatzgruppen and had murdered your family. That's a different kind of silence. That's a profound silence. And there's something very attractive about that. Your ways are not my ways, says the Bible. God in his utter transcendence defies human language. All the great mystics always remind us that language doesn't fit, that God's nature is ineffable, can't be described. But there's something deeply troubling about this as well. If you cannot talk about the Holocaust, then the Holocaust will disappear from human memory. There won't be classes like Professor Nepper's class, because the dean is not willing to pay Professor Nepper a salary to come and sit in his class and be silent for 15 weeks. When I teach my Holocaust class, if I came in and told them, you know, it's a very important event, but I can't tell you anything about it, they would rightfully be disappointed. Silence can have the capacity, unintended, right? It's always the unintended consequences that come back to bite us. Here the iatrogenic consequence is that if we say we insist on silence, then we drop the Holocaust out of human history because we can't talk about it. And then, of course, what will it mean? It will mean nothing to anyone after the survivors disappear. It will mean nothing to any of those of us, almost all of us now, who are not there. So that, too, is not without deep, deep problems. So in effect, you see that thinking about this is required, as I said at the beginning. Someone who wants to be seriously theologically engaged, whether it's a Jew, a Muslim, a Christian, has to think about the Holocaust. On the other hand, what they have to say in conclusion is not at all evident. It's not at all evident, because the problems are enormous. And whether we can give an explanation or merely a response is also an open question. But we can only answer it after we do all the other spade work that would give us some kind of grounds for making a sufficient argument. Thank you very much.
Sounds like Professor Patton wants to stay another night, so we'll come back tomorrow and do the Q&A. I'm sure you have lots of questions to ask Professor Katz now. Do you have
Please.
Some time for questions?
Easy questions are very welcome. Please. Yes, please. Would you stand up? I think everybody will hear you better.
Sure. So I'm forming this question as I'm asking it, but my study of the Holocaust has been mostly historical, not theological. And so I wonder if there are any theologians who have looked at the Holocaust not as a short span of looking at evidence for God from 33 to 45, but more on like a daily and hourly basis, because historically, what I've been struck with reading people's memoirs is their own perception of God's presence on a daily basis, even though they were suffering greatly. And
oh yes, there's no question that when people want to affirm the existence of God after Auschwitz, many have used that sort of evidence, you know, that in the midst of the worst horror. I'll give you an example. There was an order that religious ceremonies were forbidden in the Warsaw Ghetto. So, despite this, every day there were at least dozens, if not hundreds, of minyanim, let's say prayer quorums, where 10 men would get together to pray, which meant that every day thousands of people took their life in their hands as theological data. I remember in 1995, I was part of the American delegation to the commemoration of the liberation of Auschwitz in January 1945 by the Russians, January 1995. And I was at the camp and I met the chief rabbi of Warsaw. That time was a very old man. And we started to talk, and I'd met him in the synagogue. He takes me around, and he shows me where he stayed. You know, it's something the survivors like to do, is to show you the barracks they were in. And he says to me, you know, Professor Katz, how I stayed alive? I said, no, how did you stay alive? And every morning, I used to get up before roll call, it was still dark, and I used to take a little piece of my bread ration from the night before, and I'd run to the next bunk, and I would trade the bread ration for the right to put on tefillin, phylacteries. And that's what saved me. I said, how could that be? You were hungry? He said, no, it meant that I was still human. Because subhuman animals don't pray. They don't worry about their relation with heaven. So that act of getting up every morning, we have women who took their life in their hands because the ritual baths. You know, there's a tradition of that when women are menstruant, they should go to the ritual bath after menstruation. The Nazis closed the ritual baths. If they didn't go to the ritual bath, then they couldn't have sexual relations with their husbands. So there were women, many women, who took life in their hands to go to the ritual bath, sneak in, break the locks, break the ice, go to the ritual bath. That's evidence. So, yes, people have paid close attention to that kind of heroism. And I would say that that's a source, especially among the ultra-Orthodox, who stress Jewish performance. There's a book by a woman named Yaffa Eliach, E-L-I-A-C-H. If you go, how many of you have been to the Holocaust Museum? Pretty good number. You know, at the Holocaust Museum, there's that one rotunda, that one hallway with all the photos. Those photos were put together by Yaffa Eliach. And she was a professor of Jewish studies at Brooklyn College. And Yaffa wrote a book about Hasidic responses to the Holocaust, where she gives these kinds of stories, you know. And they play a big role in the kind of teaching of the Holocaust in Orthodox circles, in ultra-Orthodox circles. You might call them hagiographical stories, miracle stories, stories about famous rebbes, famous sages, students, or whatever. But it plays an important role in that the people stood firm, and that had a significance that was almost salvific, both for them individually, that kept their sanity, kept their piety, and maybe even in the world above at residences. So yes, those kinds of events are well discussed and very important. Please. Yes, sir, please. Oh, Professor Skull, please stand up.
What if there is no philosophical answer to the question, or even the logical answer to the question? Because each of the answered each of the responses you talked about had something wrong with it when you talked about that yourself. But there was nothing wrong with the stories that you just told. And what about the possibility, I mean, that the response was the preservation of those stories? Because, I mean, those people were responding within the context of the event itself. So there's something true about those responses.
Yes, no question there's something true
about that. That it seems to me philosophy doesn't, in its own way, and I teach philosophy.
God will forgive you.
That philosophy in its own way doesn't come close to it.
So maybe,
you know, the answer or the appropriate response is not philosophy, but narrative. And narrative from within the event itself that shows something about hope and religion and the nature of meaning.
I would say that's a very pertinent, very profound even observation. However, having said that and agreeing with you, there is a kind of dimension to this sort of literature, to this, which can then be expanded. Because what happens is when I was trained as an analytic philosopher at Cambridge. So if you used only the tools of analytic philosophy, you would miss something about theology. Right? There's something that goes on about belief and believers and transcendence that you can't just measure by Ayer's principle of verification. But on the other hand, I still think you can't escape the philosophical questions altogether. Because, first of all, you have to decide what's going to count and what's not going to count. And then you get into questions of criteria and verification. And secondly, you would still have to ask questions about truth, right? Philosophers talk about truth. So telling stories about rebbes will not be sufficient. You can tell stories, and I don't, for the moment, raise the methodological question of whether they're true or not. Agreeing that they're true, what will the consequence of that be? Now, maybe for their own disciples, it'll have this different meaning. A Lubavitcher Chassid, who hears a story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, obviously, is a different meaning than somebody else who's not a Lubavitcher Chassid, right? For them, it becomes revelation. God's working through the Rebbe, and so on. But I would say you can't avoid philosophical questions altogether. You can postpone them. And it may be that what you've said is very wise. We should postpone them till we do a lot of other things. So the first two questions might go together. We study the stories, we study the examples, we study the narrative, right? Study other kinds of literature. But then I think we still have to ask the philosophical question, what is the value of literature? What kind of truth does literature convey? That's not a small matter. Does literature provide sufficient grounds for belief? Can we defend the entire system of mitzvot on stories? Are we going to change? Then we get into other interesting questions, like we have the suggestion from many theologians, like Yitz Greenberg and others, that we should change Jewish law because of the Holocaust. Right? So, for example, Yitz Greenberg suggests that we change the definition of who is a Jew because of the Holocaust. Now, as you some most of you probably know, the traditional definition of who is a Jew is you either have a Jewish mother or you go through a legitimate conversion by a religious court. Yitz says, because the Nazis' definition defined even people who had only a Jewish father as Jews, we should change the halacha, change Jewish law to now be more inclusive, to say if you have a Jewish father, you're Jewish, not only a Jewish mother. But then you have to ask the question, what status does Hitler's actions have in Jewish law? Right? It's a legal question. A lawyer would ask that. What status does Hitler have in halacha? He has no status. So what he did counts for nothing. You see, so they're not so simple. You have to see that these problems might be wisely, I stress, because I thought your question was a good one, wisely deferred, even deferred for quite a long time, until you engage in a lot of historical knowledge and a lot of other kinds of knowledge, and you read Primo Levi, and you read Borowski, This Way to the Gas, and you read Ellie's Night, and you read, you know, all the other things that have been written. But still, you're not going to be able to forever avoid these questions, I think.
Yeah,
or some version of these questions. Yes, sir.
Good to see you again, Professor.
Nice to see you.
Something that we touched upon in Professor Necker's class earlier today but didn't actually engage directly was the notion of God revealing himself in history.
Right.
And something that I found very concerning as we're reading your book is that individuals take historical events and say that this proves that God is interacting with the world. They take a discrete material event in history and say that somehow God relates to this.
Right.
And my question then is, where do you draw the line once you begin that kind of process? I mean, there were people in Nazi Germany who believed that the rise of Hitler and the destruction of Jewry was divine. Or, you know, Glenn Beck thinks that America was founded by divine sanction. I mean, where do you stop and say this is or is not divine?
Right. No, that's an absolutely perfect question, a reasonable question. What I would say is that, first of all, it's a difficult question. As I told you this afternoon in the seminar, it's a very difficult question, how historical events might be revelatory. I would say that you have to, if you tried to go down that route, you gave three examples, right? Beck, Hitler, and so on, Tuzin. One of the things that, given the nature of biblical religion and the nature of the God of the Bible, despite lots of complexities, I think is the notion that ethical demands, God's ethical demands, not just ethics, God's ethical demands are central to his interaction with the world. Right? The reason that he's against Pharaoh is because Pharaoh's evil. The reason he doesn't like the people who live in the land of Israel and expels them is because they're idolaters, pagans, worshippers of all kinds of odd things, sacrifice their children. So there's a continual emphasis that God relates to the world ultimately, organizes the world ultimately in some kind of ethical way. And I'd say that you'd have to think deeply about events and how you might manage those. For example, take the third Reich, right? The Hitler state. If you measure that by any ethical standard except their own, which is to redefine all morality by racial criteria, you can't possibly see that. Heidegger notwithstanding, your specialty, Professor Skull, you can't see the Third Reich as having any sanction. On the other hand, Beck, though you may not like Beck, you might say that the United States, you could make at least have an interesting conversation, right? What was the phrase we used to use in American history 100 years ago? Manifest destiny, right? Remember the president of the University of Wisconsin, I think was one of the ones who founded it. And someone asked somebody, have you seen the last book by, I think it was Charles Beard? He said, I hope so. It's not self-evident that you want to follow Beck, but that's an interesting thesis, right? America has certain ethical, you could measure certain ethical and development in America, right? All the constitutional amendments that continue to expand freedom from women to blacks to all the legislation that involves the handicap notions about the elderly, even with regard to animal rights, right? I mean, there's a whole body of extraordinary legislation that's been passed in the last, since the Civil War, if not more recently, that would argue that there is something really quite extraordinary. On the other hand, the evidence would be hard to make because we get ourselves into silly wars. Right? Afghanistan, Iraq, these things. On the other hand, we were late to World War II. If they hadn't bombed Pearl Harbor, we may still be sitting on the sidelines. So it would be a complicated case, but I think you would involve yourself in a conversation about what would be appropriate criteria for divine action based on historical conversations about preconditions, let's say God's previous actions, and what that might look like. Now, that would not give you a knockdown argument. They say, I don't think you'd ever be able to confirm, unless God came out of the whirlwind like he did to Job and said, this is what I mean, right? But I think you'd start to have some interesting conversations along those lines. You're trying to construct the right typology of criteria, apply it, but honestly, right? Beck doesn't apply it honestly. He doesn't see the warts, he only sees the roses. You have to see the complicated story. In all of these cases, and then against your criteria, which is conceptual, not historical, you would measure and see where you come out, whether at least you have a plausible basis for some sort of plausible belief. Not knocked down absolute, but plausible. You could converse about it. Please. One last good question? Yes, sir. Is it a good question? Oh, Irish. Come on. Stand up. At least you should wear long pants to my lecture.
It relates to the creation of Israel in the aftermath of World War II. How do you justify that? I mean, the uprooting of countless Palestinian civilians from their homeland. I'm just curious if it relates to current...
No, it's a fair question. I would say that anyone who wants to engage in a conversation with about this issue has to see the historical record for what it is. First of all, the state of Israel has the existence of Israel has a long prehistory before 1948 and the Palestinians, right? The Jews have been engaged in the settlement of land since the 1880s, really, when the first settlements were established. They've been buying land. Also, you know, under the Ottoman state, they controlled the land of Israel as part of the Ottoman Empire. About 70% of the land was state-owned land. Nobody owned it. It was neither Jews nor owned it, nor the Arabs nor owned it. And if you look at your population figures, you'll see that, for example, from the late 19th century on, the Jews, for example, were a majority in Jerusalem. So does that mean Jerusalem should be Jewish, but some other part not? So these are not simple, just so simple as the story is usually told. Secondly, there's such a thing as collective rights, right? The fact is that you have 52 Muslim states, you can make the argument, I think it's 52 or 53 in the United Nations. And even if you go to South Africa, it's a place called Kruger National Park, where they feel it's right that elephants and tigers should have a place that they're safe. So in this whole big universe, that the land of Israel, which is about the size of New Jersey, should be a place over against 52 other Muslim countries, there is a kind of natural justice that the Jewish people, with this long association with the land, should also be entitled to a place of self-definition, self-promotion for its interests, its language, and so on. So I think the case for the state of Israel is much stronger than is usually implied, because if you see it only in moral terms. The other thing is those Muslims who stayed, Arabs who stayed, became citizens in the state of Israel. And despite all of the rhetoric, every time the Muslim population, the state of Israel, is given the possibility of leaving and becoming citizens in Gaza, they stay. They would prefer to be Israeli citizens. So the record of the state of Israel, actually, with regard to many things, not perfect, certainly imperfect. Lots of injustice, lots of two standards, lots of incorrect behavior with regard to the Arab minority. But still, in a tough neighborhood, under five wars or six wars, whatever it's been now, with an ingathering of all the exiles, there were 600,000 Jews in Israel in 1947. There were about 1.5 million Jews imported to the land that these 600,000 took care of. There were hundreds of millions of people on the move, literally hundreds of millions of people on the move at the end of World War II. Germans who were deported from Poland, Russians who were deported from the West, Vulgar Germans who were deported from the Soviet Union, Turks and Greeks made exchanges. All these populations have been settled. You don't hear anything about these population revisions, right? There were about 800,000 to 900,000 Jews in Muslim countries, left Muslim lands because they were afraid of violence, went to the land of Israel. Do they go and claim now that they're going to go back to Iraq and have their land? No, because they don't have the collective rights in Iraq. They went as individuals. So these issues are much more complicated. I would say that the argument for the state of Israel is sound in overall terms, recognizing all kinds of complexities, that anyone who defends the right of the Jewish people to have a state of their own is on the side of natural justice, given the way the world was organized into states, and that the record, despite all the rhetoric, for example, the rhetoric of genocide, which is leveled against the state of Israel. The fact is, you look at the Arab population, genocide means the destruction of a group, right? You look at the number of Arab citizens in the state of Israel since 48, they've multiplied to the point where it's predicted in about 2050, 2070, there'll be a majority if we include Gaza and the West Bank. The populations of Gaza and West Bank since 67 have multiplied dramatically. I can't tell you the exact numbers, but dramatically under Jewish occupation. So there's been, despite all the rhetoric of murder and so on, there's much more murder going on in Syria today, right? I think 60,000 plus people have been murdered in Syria in the last year. Certainly nowhere in the 50 years since 48, what's that? 70 years since 48, do you have anything like that? When Israel responds to 10,000 rockets being shot into Gaza from Gaza, it seems that that would be a reasonable response, given the number of people that were injured after 3 years of bombardment. If Canada had been bombarding New York State or Michigan with rockets for 3 years and the United States decided to go into Canada, I don't think anyone would see that as immoral. So on the whole, it's a complicated record. But as you can see from this brief conversation, I think there are there is as always a lot of data, a lot of evidence, a lot of argument that is usually ignored. And when it's all factored in, both the legitimacy and the morality of Israel's position, all things taken into consideration, is on the side of light, not on the side of darkness. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out.